Lama Padaya Tasana, Aman, 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 Aman. We know salam, we know to say peace in Arabic. Aman is safety. The song is sung by Feruz, the sweetheart of all Middle Easterns. Young, old, you walk by any store, any shop, any coffee, jump into any taxi, any bus. And people in Syria, Iraq, Jordan, Lebanon, everyone is listening to Feruz in the morning. And I like to start with that song to call us into the spirit of the beautiful Arabic language, and to think of safety, how it's repeated 8 times or more throughout that song as she sings it. Peter was right. We started with Voices in the Wilderness years ago, and that's where I'll begin, but we will have 4 parts of our talk. The first will be us and how we ended up in Syria and how we did Iraqi Student Project. The second part will be what kind of a place is Syria? The third will be our view of Syria from personal experiences. And finally, in the last 18 months, what's going on, what's happening, and what should we do? So at the beginning, we were in Voices in the Wilderness. We were activists. But when the U.S. invaded Iraq, we thought, now what do we do? What would be the most important thing? And we didn't really know. So Gabe was a retired publisher, and I had been teaching 30 years. And we thought, let's go live in the Middle East and try to learn Arabic. It's really hard if you're old. But we tried, and we studied, and we had a teacher. And that was in 2005. And then in 2007, we had this idea, what would be a great way to make reparations to the people of Iraq? Education. It's one of the great things we have in our country, a great system of higher education. What if we could get scholarships for Iraqi students? What if we could find students among the Iraqi community who, because of the sanctions and the war, never got to finish college or maybe never even got to enter? So we formed a board. Someone told us get a website to help us get that going, and we went back to Damascus in 2007 and began to identify Iraqi students between the ages of 18 and 23. And our hope was to liaison with colleges and just ask them, could you give a scholarship as a form of reparations? It worked, and we learned more year by year, and we did it over a 5-year period. How we did this in Syria was we identified students who already spoke English. So we didn't start as a language institute. If the students spoke English, had aspirations for college, and were emotionally resilient, students who were willing to go on an F1 visa, which would be for the purpose of studying, not to resettle. And in our interview, we would say, where do you see yourself in 10 years? And we were trying to find students who felt they could be part of the future of Iraq, that their generation would be part of the solution, inshallah, God willing, after they had their master's or any other study that they wanted to pursue. We were blessed in Syria because Damascus is a great town if you want to go and learn Arabic. So people would come from Ivy League colleges and other U.S. colleges to go study Arabic in Damascus. Some of them were employed at the British Council or the American Language Center, and we used those folks to be our volunteer teachers. We had a tiny grant for materials from Oxford University Press, which stresses college preparation. Read, write, listen, and speak. How do you listen to a college lecture? How do you take notes? How do you write critically about a piece that you've read? And that became our materials. In addition, I taught literature circles, and over the course of this year, we read 15 books, and it worked like a book club with the students discussing the themes. Often, the books were chosen because it paralleled the issues that they faced as Iraqis. We had a writer's workshop, and this is a result of writer's workshop, and all the writing was done in English. It was based on the National Writing Project model. and empowered kids who had been used to a memorization, lecture, memorized test method to how do you write about it critically. We also had content courses. So Gabe taught a course called Understanding Palestine to give the kids the meat and potatoes of what happened in 1948, what happened in 67, what are the facts that they need to know to talk about issues that relate to Palestine. And we had a film component, film and discussion. So once a week we watched a film series. One was Eyes on the Prize, which talked about the civil rights movement, and the other was A Force More Powerful that showed the use of nonviolence worldwide. And that was a great eye-opener and a way for the students to discuss. We only had one paid employee in the U.S. that was the liaison between us, the colleges, the students who were already studying here. But outside of that, we had all the teachers work for free. Gabe and I were volunteers, and we had conversation partners that were other English speakers in Damascus who would match up with each of our students and be able to give them more opportunities to speak English. So our program was going great, small groups of students, and we never accepted money from the U.S. government, the Iraqi government, or the Syrian government. And that enabled us to move quickly and by the seat of our pants, create a program that we called Iraqi Student Project. We know that the Syrian government knew that we did Iraqi Student Project. It was never a secret. We were out there, and in fact, the first year, a magazine called What's On did an article about Iraqi Student Project and had our email and phone number in the magazine. Things changed because of the situation in Syria, because in the last 18 months, as the situation was escalating and getting more violent, we couldn't get enough teachers because the ones who were funded by colleges here weren't getting funded to go study Arabic in Syria. And some who were there, even Fulbrighters, said, my mom and dad want me to go home. So we were losing teachers who had been there. And then we lost the connection to American Language Center, British Council, Cervantes Center, all the cultural centers where our students could go, use the computers, use the library, get a coffee, and feel like they were a student. Because those cultural centers and embassies were closing in Syria. It was harder to get money because we couldn't use our card at the ATM. There were shortages of cooking gas, electricity, sometimes even food items that you think would be normal, like yogurt. Because of checkpoints coming into Damascus, it was hard for that product to come in here and there. So Gabe and I made the choice that we would stay in Syria all year because we worked on an academic year. And yes, things were escalating, and yes, things were not as safe as they were in past years. And Gabe began teaching more, and I began teaching more as our students lost some of the teachers that they had. But we knew when the school year is over in July, then we'll be able to return to the U.S. One other aspect of Iraqi Student Project and living in Syria is that we fell in love with Syria. We love the people, and we've been there 7 years. So we've been to baptisms, weddings, funerals, and we just love it there. And we wanted to share that experience with other people, so we invented something called Springtime in Syria. And every year we would invite our friends and families and acquaintances and anybody who knew someone who knew us to come to Syria for about a 10-day period. And we usually put it the week before Easter. And we would travel outside of Damascus to historical sites and just soak up the history and the ancient beauty of Damascus and of Syria. So that's a little bit about Iraqi Student Project, and we can tell you more about it in the question part. But again, this book is the legacy of those students, the 8 students we had this year who wrote this book in response to the classes we had on nonviolence. There's prose pieces, there's haiku, there's odes. So we invite you to look at the book at the end. Thank you.
There's also, though we don't have copies of it, a book that has the writing of the students from the first 4 years. I think there are still some available in this country. The idea of they're put together and printed in Damascus and as a way to bring people in contact with these students, and especially with their love of Iraq, and their, in this year's book, more than ever, their feelings about what has happened to their land. So you have the picture of our life the last 5 years since Iraqi Student Project began. Our apartment was the Iraqi Student Project, where the students spent 5 hours, 5 days a week with their classes, and from September until June, all with the idea that they would, if we could find admission and scholarship and visa, they would come here for undergraduate studies. And about 60 over these 5 years have come. We stayed last night with a young man who was part of the first group who graduated this year from Fairfield University in Connecticut and is in the dental college at UPenn now. And so he's going to be your neighbor here for years to come as he works his way through the dental college there. But that's the others, little by little, will be finishing up. And after this year, at least next year, there won't be any new students because of the many difficulties that Teresa mentioned. I want to just do, Syria is, you know, been plastered all over the TV and the newspapers these last 18 months, increasingly so, I think. I mean, we're out of it most of the time, but we can see where, though we've been asked from the very beginning, if you tell somebody you're living in Syria, their first question was usually, are you safe there? Our first question back to them ought to have been, can you tell me where it is? Because, for the most part, they wouldn't be able to. I want to say a few things about Syria as a country, because that doesn't get talked about in the stories of who destroyed what. We'll get to that. The name Syria is really that whole land that once embraced what's now Syria, Lebanon, Israel, Palestine, Jordan, parts of what is now Iraq, parts of what is now Saudi Arabia. I mean, it wasn't a nation. It was an area. And as it went through different periods, it was Roman or Greek or eventually Ottoman or part of Islamic caliphate, both starting in Damascus and when it moved to Baghdad. So it only became what we think of as the way to be, a nation state, after World War I and the defeat of the Ottoman Empire and the carving up of the Middle East by Britain and France. And the carving left a Lebanon, left a Syria, left an Iraq, left a Jordan, Transjordan, as it was then. And so Syria became a nation state with France as a colonial power there from early 1920s until 1946, during which time there were many rebellions of various sorts against the French power. And it was after two rather stormy decades of independence where there were coups, but there was also a kind of a period people look back on fondly of building a nation through all of that. By the late 60s and until now, the Ba'ath Party, Ba'ath is a word that means really rebirth or resurrection, by the way, and that's what it was founded for among Arab peoples, to break those nation-state boundaries and be pan-Arab, all Arabs as one people. Syria perhaps has stayed to that more than other countries. It's a population of somewhere in the mid-20 million people, mostly in that north-south corridor along its western borders, along the Mediterranean and then bordering Lebanon. economy has never been. They say they produce enough oil to for their own needs, but they don't refine it there. So it's a matter of imports and export. There isn't any great source of wealth except the people and the wonderful fruits and vegetables that grow on the edge of the mountains from north to south there. So it has been self-sufficient in many ways, but not prosperous. It feeds itself, but not a lot of things to export. But certainly in a critical position. The ethnicities there are certainly Arab, but that Arab includes people who came from Palestine in 48 and 67, and their children and their grandchildren and great-grandchildren now. It's a large population. It includes the Iraqis, who at one point were probably 1.5 million refugees in Syria in 2005, 6, 7. Some have gone back. Many, many are still there. There's a Kurdish population, especially in the north, but in the certainly in Damascus, also in the south. Circassian peoples, Armenian population, who came not just from the persecution in the early part of the 20th century, but long before that, as merchants and traders. Religiously, it's predominantly Muslim, of course, but there's been a Christian population ever since there were Christians. And that is something that people forget quite easily. The Druze, there's now a Mandaean population because most of the Mandaean community, or Sabaean, as some people call them, have left Iraq in the time since the U.S. invasion. And a tiny remnant of the Jewish population that was once and had been in Damascus, likewise, even longer than Christians. It seems to us to have been a nation largely what we think of as lower middle class, and certainly a nation at the kind of the bottom of the non-rich countries, but the top of the really poor countries, somewhere in there. A nation of people with farmers and merchants. You know, a nation of the descendants of people who passed through, conquering or not conquering, and in one era or another, and stayed. A nation that owes much of its heritage to the blossoming of Islam, in which there were Muslims, Christians, and Jews involved in the 9th to the 14th century. And not forgetting that legacy, even though the times are much harder for them now. The last 10 years since Bashar al-Assad came to power in 2000 have seen changes, but, you know, how profound, it's hard to say. I mean, the people get any channel they want on television. Satellite dishes were allowed then. Internet was allowed. International papers have been readily available all through this troubled time, and certainly were before that. People generally have not had a hard time traveling outside Syria if their own income allowed for it. There would still be a Baathist socialist side to Syrian life, that the poor are cared for, but there has also been, I don't know what you call it, the China phenomenon, I guess, of at the same time, people are allowed to get very rich. There are not a lot of those, but they are part of the picture now also. It's, in mentioning Palestinians and Iraqis, everybody should acknowledge Syria as a receiver of refugees. Years ago, Teresa said that the Statue of Liberty ought to be hauled over and put out off the coast of Syria and the Mediterranean, because they really have taken the tired and the poor and the huddled masses and all that. And we saw it in 2006 when between 100 and 200,000 people just on the spur of the moment arrived from southern Lebanon when Israel invaded the most recent time. Those mostly returned home, but certainly the Palestinians have not, and most of the Iraqis have not, a receiver of refugees. And the other Ba'athist quality that hangs on in a way is the secular nature of the state, that stretched in different ways perhaps, but that has been the point there, that this is not a nation governed by one religion or another, but a secular state. Damascus itself, where we lived these 7 years, it's a city of merchants and government workers, like a lot of capital cities, I guess, with people without great expectations, people without, large part, great pressures on themselves, not unhappy with that. They took in stride these changes that came. There's a UN handbook from early 2000s that say there's something like 16 telephones for every 100 people in Syria. Now I think there's 16 telephones for every single person in Syria. I mean, these things get there and take over just like they do here. It's been interesting to us how people clearly religiously identify themselves as Muslim or as Christian. It seems a very deep part of people's understanding of their identity, of who they are. For many, it doesn't have that many external manifestations, both Muslim and Christian. But it's certainly part of that self-understanding of self, of family, of community. And that's got to be kept in mind. We talk about sectarianism in Syria in this recent period. The question is sometimes, how unhappy were Syrian people as we knew them if we went back 2 years before any disturbances there started? And all we know is what we know, and that's Damascus. And the disturbances started in rural areas. Were people thinking we need a revolution? Most people that we know would say they were not. It's an important question to think about. Next part is going to be Teresa talking about what we saw of the effect of the beginnings of the opposition, nonviolent and violent.
During the time that we lived in Syria, we lived in four different areas or neighborhoods, and all of them have been affected by what's been going on. The first area is the Old City, which was traditionally a Christian area, and we got to know people there that year. Then we moved to the Palestinian area called the Muhayyim Yarmouk for 2 years near Mustashfa, Palestine, because our teacher was there. And it was a great jump in Arabic for us because there weren't foreigners and there weren't tourists like there was in the Old City. So it was good for us to get to know people in the Muhayyim Yarmouk. Later, because the size of our program demanded a place to be in the center where different Iraqi refugees could all approach, we moved to a working class neighborhood, Sahat Arnous, and then later up the hill a little bit, Sharia Afif. So in all those neighborhoods, we came to know people, and we saw how they changed when the troubles came. First, people began to talk. And in our other years there, people did not talk about the government. They didn't express wishes for what would happen. They didn't say things against the Ba'ath Party. But suddenly, we were at the chair store in our neighborhood talking with the two guys and having tea, And one old man just said in front of us, 50 years of the Boss Party, it's really enough. It's time for a change. And we were so surprised because we never would have heard anybody say something like that in front of us in years past. But now people had a willingness to talk. Things were being stirred up by all of this. And even sitting on a bus, there's sometimes the seats face this way and that, and you're seeing each other. And you could hear the other person talking about the government. And you never would have heard that on the bus. So that was pretty amazing. And even the juice bar where we would go to buy juice, they would be talking about governmental issues. So that evolving attitude for me was most seen by the women who worked at the public bath. So for $8 a week in Damascus, I could get a really great massage at the public bath. I could practice Arabic, and I could be in a culture of women for about 4 hours each week. And at the beginning of my years at the hammam, the women would say things, especially at the beginning of the troubles with the government, I would die for Bashar al-Assad, said the woman who worked the front desk. And not only I would, but my son would. My son would give his life for the president. But as these 18 months of troubles pass, they begin to talk more about the danger in their neighborhoods, about people using arms, about the lack of things that they needed like electricity and gas. And sometimes they would say, nobody cares about Syrians. It's just a game, and the big powers are moving around. It's Iran. It's your government. It's China. It's Russia. It's all these other people, Saudi. They're trying to just move around as if we don't exist, and we're suffering from it. And later, when it was almost time to go and I was with those same women, one of them said, when you come back, God willing, to Syria, and you come to this bath, maybe we won't be here. Maybe all of us will have died. So I could see that complete change into a sense of hopelessness and a sense of that they don't have power over what's going on in their country. A family we got close to in the old city, Papa Yosef and his family, suffered economically right off the bat because his job was working with tourists. So tourists would come, people would come to his shop, and he sold earrings, tiles, carpets, all the beautiful things you could find in Damascus. And he would sit down and talk with people. He spoke seven languages. And it was a center of visitors to come. But he had no source of income because during these 18 months, no visitors and no tours are going to Syria. And that affected other people who were guides, people who sold materials, maps, everything. And now all the merchants in Damascus were going broke. And one of the last visitors we had saw a beautiful silk scarf on a street called Straight. And she said, oh, that is so beautiful. How much do you think that costs? I said, I don't know, $85, $100? It's pure silk, and it has five different colors, and it's woven in a special way. And she went up to the man and inquired about it. He said, that scarf, just take it. Because he was so disgusted from not having customers. And I said, no, that's crazy. She'll pay for it. He said, okay, $20. And I said, don't do that, you know, give him 40. Or, you know, it was just so insane that it was the opposite of bargaining. It was somebody just giving up with his shop. Later, Papa Yosef's family was affected in a deeper way when their neighborhood was struck by missiles that were probably sent, I can't even identify who by, but it blew up their neighbor's apartment building and their apartment building, but they lived in the basement. So their windows blew out, the doors blew out, their ceiling fell in, but no one was injured. So now economically they're bad off, and now they're living in their house that's been destroyed. A more positive example is a friend of ours, Anahid, and she's Syrian from Armenian extract, and she had been the manager for about 23 years for American Language Center. And way before it was necessary, the American Embassy closed. And they closed the language center, leaving Syrians who were trying to learn English for many reasons, not to mention dialogue with East and West, were stranded without this language center. But Anahid and the other women thought, wait a minute, we can run this place. We know how to do it. They were the business manager, the curriculum director, the teacher trainer. The women knew how to run this American language center. So they went to the Syrian Ministry of Education and said, we want to reopen it. We'll change the name to ALTC. So it's a teaching and learning center, and they kept the center going, so the 44 Syrians who worked there all kept their jobs. And when we left Syria, the books, that many that we used with Iraqi Student Project, donated to that center, so now they have a library. So we felt that Anahid and many others aren't giving up. They're trying to keep things going. A family in the Palestinian area, Kifa and Fadel, have opened their home to become an early childhood center for kids and moms, and also a type of language center. And one of the volunteer teachers we had is helping them now keep that going. They've been affected by violence in that neighborhood, and they've been affected when it was so violent that up to 30 people came and stayed in their tiny home to be able to have a place to feel that they were safe. The area of homes sent many refugees to Damascus. And in the apartment below us, a family came from homes whose apartment had been blown up. And they brought some things in their suitcases. But later, Inam was the mom. Her sister came from Midan, another area that was heavily struck with mortars and missiles. And her sister brought more kids. And then they have another sister from Hama. And these three women and all of their children brought the number up to maybe 16 kids and grown-ups. And it was Ramadan, and here they're trying to celebrate. And sometimes they would send a dish of food up to us, you know, a dish of beans or some barley and lentils. And it was wonderful having them down there. But they would show sometimes on their cell phone a picture of what had happened to their neighborhood. Shopkeepers on the street were losing money so much, but then a new phenomena came where anybody would just take a blanket, throw it on the sidewalk, and put out things to sell. So that really transformed how streets were looking. The value of money, of course, is really going crazy. And with the sanctions, there's items that people cannot get, certain medicines that you need if you're an oncologist for your cancer patients. Even our dentist, there are certain materials that he couldn't get, that he had to travel outside of the country to get basic materials for dentistry. And this sense of chaos and a lack of trust where the people themselves don't know, can you trust each other? And that feels so bad in civil society, and everybody being very sad, and the faces changing to sad faces. The Iraqis, for a while, just kept being refugees and thinking, uh-oh, this feels like Iraq, uh-oh, we've seen this before. But as more neighborhoods were brought into this circle of violence, Iraq offered planes that would give Iraqis a free ride out back to Baghdad. And some of the families we know thought, should we do that? Should we go back to Baghdad? And a few did. And one of our ISP families relocated to Lebanon after their student came here to study in Illinois. Again, that sense of disorientation on the street, this just like thrown a curtain of sadness and body language now, instead of walking proud and happy down the street and how are you, it's more of a, you know, what's going to happen next. And I think Gabe will now talk about what's going on in these 18 months and what can we do.
Okay, kind of quickly, and again, we're, in some ways our information is more limited than what people who really make an effort to find out here can find out. But I want us to remember that this began nonviolently in the town of Dara near the Jordanian border in the south of Syria. And it began in a kind of sequence with the Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, Bahrain, Jordanian protests, a bit later than most of those. So the was natural to think of it as part of the so-called Arab Spring. There are some who would say one should look at, without Western eyes, at how these movements might arise in Arab countries also. There's a book called Life as Politics by Asaf Bayat, B-A-Y-A-T, who before any of this happened was really exploring the ground from which it would come. But those nonviolent beginnings, to I think the amazement of most Syrians, perhaps more than the rest of the world, were met by violence from the regime. The use of force, the military forces, and later non-military, the so-called Shabia, using violence, arms, torture. A non-violent side still exists, though you don't read about it very much. There was a piece somewhere a couple of weeks ago about an interview with one of the people involved in that, probably the leadership, LCC, Leadership Coordinating Committee in Syria, the in Syria part of the opposition that has stayed nonviolent, talking about now we have 1 minute protests. People get the word around where they will meet each other. It's 60 seconds and they're gone. Any longer than that, they know what will happen. But they're holding on to that. But so eclipsed in the press outside by the turn to violence on the part of the opposition, which also happened quickly in the spring of 2011, that it was not very many weeks before the regime's violence was being met by violence from the other side, and what eventually became not simply the Free Syrian Army, but all the tentacles and so on that really operate independently there. And that is what has always captured the world's attention in the months since, the violent conflict between this diverse opposition, which the West has been very slow, I think, to realize is diverse. All those meetings that Hillary went to of the Friends of Syria and so on, acting as if either the leadership was outside Syria, which there were people, but they were not much listened to by the people in Syria, and which of those organizations to support. While inside, Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington had a line in an article this spring or summer, "Network of militias and fighters, unaccountable and uncoordinated." And that's really what it is, a network of militias and fighters, unaccountable and uncoordinated. We've been struck often in reading the press from the West in the assumptions that they make about Syria. I jotted one down because it was so striking. The Guardian, maybe in July or August. "Syria has long been the region's most uncompromising police state." I say, really? Really? You realize what you're comparing it to when you say that? For many Americans, Syria is simply that country that we've heard every year when the new list of sponsors of terrorism is put out by the government. Syria has made the list, I don't know how long, decades. Even when we were sending that Canadian that was captured at JFK and sent to Syria for torture by the U.S. government. You can't untangle it and what it all means. Perhaps the most disturbing thing to think about as we think about where are we, and we get this American sense of we have to do something. We're America. We must do something about this. Look at those horrible pictures. Look at what the regime forces did to those innocent people. We have to do something. the thing that has happened since last winter, since the focus was on the city of Homs, and that has continued, Hama, Aleppo, parts of Damascus in August and September, some part or other of the opposition fighters go into uninvited into an urban area, and from there begin attacks on police stations and government forces and other things that represent the regime. They do this by now knowing full well what the response will be. The regime will come in with their heavy weapons and destroy the neighborhood. The people who moved into our building from Homs, that was the case. They were not part of any opposition. They were part of what was destroyed by the Assad regime in Homs, in this immense firepower and now air power released in order to drive out the opposition, who probably mostly escaped unharmed. They do this knowing that their means of communication, which is the YouTube films and so on, will be seen around the world, and the pictures from it will appear in the world's papers, and that the pressure will grow on the U.S. and other countries to take a stand, to support the rebels, to send arms, and perhaps to intervene. I mean, there are different levels of what they want to happen, but I think that is the tactic, and it is to us equivalent to the taking of hostages as a tactic. They take as hostage the people in these urban areas, and the residents and their homes are what suffers. And we see the horrors inflicted by the regime, but we don't ask the second question so often. After 18 months of of this, ordinary people have moved from, I think, from, well, like Teresa said, it's about time. Yes, it was about time. And with perhaps some hope that this would result in a change of how Syria is governed, have moved to thinking that it will probably go on for a very long time. And if you ask the question, what next, the answer is going to be, it will be worse than when we started. That's pretty much the case in Iraq also. So the destruction of the state. You do find occasionally now, and the Times had a piece September 30th, interviewing someone in Aleppo which continues, this tactic of being used there. A woman, Dima, who's a doctor, and who supports the opposition. She believed the fire in the Aleppo souk, the historic souk there, had been started by incendiary bullets from government snipers, but she blamed the rebels for approaching the old city, which she said had no government target, and said they seemed more concerned with the number of areas they could seize than with their tactical importance. She said they are not the army of freedom, they are the army of spite. I think, though not everybody could be that clear and eloquent about it, perhaps that is what people have moved to, with this resignation that it will be worse than it was before. We can say things about the media and the questions they emphasize and so on, but I want to just throw out some things about the question, what can we as a country, as the U.S., do? Because it seems to be that we have a very narrow perception in this country of how to be of help. I'll just toss these out. We could lean on our friends, especially the Saudis and Qatar, to stop fanning the flames, as they're doing by sending in weapons and money. We could stop being of any assistance in arms going into Syria through Turkey. And it's been, feels like common knowledge since the spring that the U.S. is there in Turkey helping decide who will get the arms. We could assist in the refugee aid to Turkey, Jordan, and Lebanon, and Iraq, too, because there are refugees there. We could stop demonizing Iran and recognize that they have to be included as a regional power in this. Instead, we've demonized Syria for being an ally of Iran. If there's some effort, I don't know if he's capable of it or not, on the new leader, Morsi, in Egypt, to bring Saudi and Iran and Turkey and Egypt together and try to mediate through those things. But the mood in the U.S. government toward Iran seems to be a real stumbling block to this totally different question than nuclear weapons. We can stop Israel from doing anything to any other country. We can end sanctions against non-military goods to Syria, as we should have to Iraq. We can understand that any end to violence means bringing Russia, China, Iran, Saudi, Turkey together to ending military assistance to all sides. If all of those countries said, that's it, starting tomorrow, you're getting nothing to the regime and to the opposition. And we can understand that we don't set preconditions. You know, that we were so quick to jump to the thing that Assad is finished and has to leave. You know, people sit down and talk with awful people. That's how these things end. And the opposition has, in Syria, divided as it is, seems to have resisted that all along. And backed by the U.S., you know, how many times did Hillary Clinton say, sure, we support Kofi Annan and his proposals, but they'll never work? Well, what kind of support is that? What is the U.S. interest in this? I mean, we have right next door the example of Iraq, you know, which we could talk about at other length for what the bad times it's in. You know, the state, the culture, the identity has been destroyed. Maybe that's what we want to see in Syria also. Maybe it will make life simpler for some of the powers in the world. So, a little bit late, but let's go to questions that you might have.
Is this working? Good. Thank you both. So we're recording this, and you know we have a library that we're creating of these kind of brown bags, and this is our first effort to understand more about Syria. So thank you, Gabe and Teresa. That was super. Time for questions. We have 20 minutes. Who has a question? Raise your hand, and I'll bring you the mic. Otherwise, I'll start. Oh, and please, just as a brief intro, just say, like, kind of who you are and maybe if you want to identify what you do or just who you are so that they know.
My name is Laura McKenna, and I'm a friend of Johanna Barrett, and that's why I'm here. But, no, I volunteer at the Catholic Worker. But I just want to know personally, where's your next move or what are your plans for where you're going now or what you plan to do now?
Thank you, Laura. Our idea when we left Syria was not to decide what to do next.
to be prayerful and thoughtful and be open and to read and listen and use these months, as I think as a teacher in the first semester of this year, to visit people and to talk and listen. We don't really know what Gabe and I are going to do next, so you can talk to us after with any ideas. While you're thinking of the next question, we do have a handout from the community of San Egidio that met in Rome, and they have more ideas, too, that relate to nonviolence. So we hope you have that handout. Do you want to comment on that handout?
There are two things. This one is the document that this conference in Rome, that the community of San Egidio, that is a non-government, has tried to assist in many conflict areas in the world by bringing people together to talk. So they had 10 or a dozen people representing various opposition points. It was not the Syrian regime represented, but various opposition points of view, I think in July, in Rome, and this document was the result of it. This is the kind of position that we don't hear much about, but it is a position of Syrians who still hold out some kind of hope. It is, I call your attention to the fifth point. The military solution is holding the Syrian people hostage and does not offer a political solution capable of responding to people's deepest aspirations. Violence leads people to think there is no alternative to the use of weapons. But the victims, the martyrs, the injured, the detained, the disappeared, the mass of refugees inside and outside the country call on us to take the responsibility and stop the spiral of violence. We commit ourselves to supporting all forms of peaceful political structure and civil resistance, and to promote a new phase of meetings and conferences inside the country. It will go on a long time, because the regime is not about to disappear. It isn't. Sure, there have been desertions, and there have been some government people step out, but there's still power there, and it's not that popular feeling of Egypt that Mubarak should go. Mubarak should go all over the place. And I'll tell you the other thing. It isn't like Egypt, because in that period of revolution, it was a nonviolent revolution, but not nonviolence on the government's part. The army did stay somewhat out of it, but 800 and some Egyptians were killed protesting. And yet it wasn't met by violence. So there is, this one has been, and it makes it so much more difficult. So we have to, as a country, be pressuring anybody we have influence on in that opposition. And we're not going to send arms, but, you know, you've got to, at some point, sit down. You cannot say before, as they've said every time, to Kofi Annan and all along, not until Assad is gone. Did Mandela wait until everybody had left from the government? You've got to sit down and talk. The other handout piece is a recent article from The Nation, A Way Out of Serious Catastrophe by Jonathan Steele, that has seemed to us one of the most insightful pieces that has come out. You know, there now are various journalists getting into Syria, especially on the north side, and sometimes into Damascus, and then writing about it. But some of it just sounds like an adventure story when they come out, and not like serious journalism. Steele is looking for at a bigger picture, and I think with the interests of the Syrian people in mind. So I hope you'll be able to read that.
Hi, Hi, my name is Linda Lotz, and I had the pleasure of visiting Damascus in 2009.
Oh.
And was after having visited in other countries where there had been so much war, it was so beautiful to be there and see a city that had not experienced war for a long time. I have two sort of opposite ends of the polar kinds of questions. Having been aware of what happened in Iraq, and particularly as Iraqis talk with families at home, they talk now about corruption. And we have a lot of Iraqi doctors and others in this area because of the process, the Phoenix program, essentially, of assassinating scientists and professors and the intelligentsia. So on one hand, I'm curious, are you seeing that kind of targeting of people? Iraqis often talked about that as never knowing who was responsible for it. On the other end of the spectrum, then, let me also ask, as you talked with people and because of the turmoil in that whole region, can people look ahead to 10 years or 15 years from now and perhaps see a complete reconfiguring of what the region might look like? I'm starting with Iran and Iraq, but trying to look at the whole region with Kurds, with Christians, with Sunni, how might the region look in a period of peace and development?
Well, the region or Syria?
More broadly, but Syria in particular.
I think Syrian people, again, in our experience, which is Damascus, take real pride in being a tolerant people. They know that people of different religious faiths have lived together peacefully since they were living together for the most part. And when it wasn't, sometimes, as always, there are other reasons involved, economic or whatever. And they think they don't want to lose that. I guess we would say that it's astounding how frequently we'll read about the threat to Christians in Syria. It's true that they have not, the leaders have not spoken out against Assad even now, and they spoke early, some of them, in a pro-Assad way in these months. But that has, I don't think, is being heard as much anymore. It's more, any speaking out now is about compassion for one another. But I think that leadership has been lacking. But the opposition includes Christians, it includes Alawites, it's not any one thing, and it says over and over, many of them do, that they don't want it based on that. But you will see an interview of somebody who's gone in and talked to somebody who is from an extreme end of Islamic belief and has a different vision for Syria, has Sharia as the law and not that kind of fairly peaceful coexistence that has been there. When you tear the fabric so severely, it's not possible to say what's going to come of it. The question of the culture and striking out against the education figures. Iraq and Syria are different in that Iraq had come a long way in terms of its education and especially higher education up until the Gulf War, and then the sanctions did their damage and the 2003 came and continued that and even continued it until now. If you're not aware of the work of the Brussels Tribunal in trying to bring Iraqis and from Iraq and Iraqis not in Iraq and Westerners who care about it together to talk about that continuing situation in Iraq, that's checking their website. They have, in the past couple of years, two publications, one called The Cultural Cleansing of Iraq. And it's really trying to document and say this is not an accident, that the museum was looted and the library burned while the U.S. stood by, and that the kidnapping and murder of so many professors and understandably the flight of so many others from Iraq, so that the system is in shambles. And the second book is called Beyond Educide, which is a word they coined to mean killing education. That's a place to at least watch, and if maybe we have ways even to become involved in the Iraqi situation. With Syria, I don't think there has been that side to what's happened so far. Probably for a variety of reasons, Syria's education was never a rival for what was going on in Iraq. I mean, it needs, without anything bad having happened in the past 2 years, it needs rebuilding and help and new vision and so on every level. But some think that if some factions that carried this on in Iraq come to Syria, that the destruction of the state is one thing, but the destruction of the sense of a people is another, and that's certainly underway in both.
I have a question, and then we have another, so if we could answer the questions quickly. I was really intrigued by your comments about there still being a network of sorts committed to nonviolent resistance and nonviolent means, and you talked about sort of, you know, these moments of action. I was just curious, given that so many of your recommendations are macro, you know, stopping the United States government from arming their militia, can you tell us a little bit of what some of the creative actions are, these one-minute demonstrations? Are they, like, what are some of the ideas that they have that are sort of invigorating people to look at some other options that, you know, that exist?
Yeah, it's a very good question, and we don't have that much insight into it. But we want to be on the look for it too, and anything that can be done to nourish that kind of opposition. Why the macro, I guess, comes is until there's some kind of cessation of violence and a rekindling of this kind of, you know, nonviolent expression of self and town and group, I think it's going to be, you know, difficult to, you know, to find out. It shouldn't be hopeless at this point, but those voices aren't being heard, you know, even inside Syria very much. But I would pay attention to what the Rome Statement says, and to the people. You can find that on the web too. More about who was there and how it happened.
We did see one nonviolent demonstration that was pretty amazing. It was college age women and a few of their mothers sitting on the ground holding doves. So that's very creative. But I accept the challenge that you give us to talk to some of the Syrians we know, the young people, to find out more specifics on that. Thanks, Peter.
I wanted to thank you for, especially for the, is this on?
Yeah.
For the kind of eyewitness account, and you know, I learned things I would not have known from even though I'm a real news junkie and I work on peace for a living. But, for example, I was really struck by your quote from the Syrian woman who said, and correct me if I'm misquoting here, but none of these powers, not China, not the U.S., not Russia, not the Saudis, et cetera, care about Syrians. We're just pawns in their game. I believe it's important to that effect. That is such a powerful message, and its message is just not getting out in the media. So one thing I try to do, my name is Ed Aguilar, and I work with the Coalition for Peace Action, and also right now we have the Pennsylvania Peace Voter Project. So one of the things we try to do is try to get this stuff out in the media, so we're not just talking to our, you know, our friends and the neighbors of the peace movement, but trying to get it out there. So, for example, on October 28th, we have Helen Caldicott coming, who's the Nobel Peace Prize winner, and she will be, she's not coming to talk about Syria specifically, but this whole issue of proxy wars and this whole issue of wars of choice. Because let's face it, that's what's really the U.S. foreign policy involvement in this sort of thing. Iraq was a war of choice. We need to avoid one of the things we've been emphasizing. We have a peace voter guide that we've been putting in ads in newspapers from Princeton to suburban Philadelphia. And we're also going to get Helen Caldicott will be on the Steve Highsmith show. I don't know if you've seen it. That issue comes on right after Meet the Press on Channel 10, I think.
Anyway.
So I think media is really important. And so whatever you can do to get this message out to the media, and I have some contacts that maybe I could help with. But also, you know,
if I may give a plug to Helen Caldicott.
We have little flyers here about that. She's actually coming to talk about her book, Loving This Planet, which, you know, is a much about more broader issues than a particular country or particular war. But, you know, we're all allies, I think, in this movement. And just thank you for this presentation. It was very informative.
Just the one quick thing to that. A friend in New York, just while we've been visiting friends in Washington and here, set up a meeting for later this week. This is very grassroots, to say, can we find resources to bring one or two of the Syrians who have been on this side of things here to talk, so that the press maybe will hear a different story, and to talk to the public also. It could be that if enough would kind of merge their efforts together, that, you know, that could be done and a different story would be heard. It should have happened in Iraq. There's a problem. Of course, they have to get visas in order to come to the U.S. And would it happen?
And just to say as a final word, each country is different. We can't look at Syria and say, oh, yeah, well, we saw Tunisia. Oh, we saw Egypt. Oh, yeah, Iran. We can't do that. Syria is a whole different thing. And I hope that some of the aspects we talked about today will make you start thinking, And when you hear folks say a statement, to be able to jump out and say, you know, I'm not sure about that. I heard this talk at the Brown Bag, and I think Syria is different. You want to add anything, Gabe?
No, I'm fine. I want to just say thank you both very much for joining us. And also, there's a sheet back there with announcements, Brandywine Peace Community announcements, so grab one of those. The articles that were referenced by Gabe are on the back table there. And I want to say one last kind of hopeful thing, that a lot of the different groups that are involved with the Answer Coalition, UFPJ, and the different big peace groups,
are trying to sort of come together for a united campaign towards the end of the year, something that will happen before the new administration comes into power. And it's really, as you all remember, it's very difficult to sort of get everybody to agree on a message or to agree on a tactic. But one of the ideas that a lot of people are talking about is a campaign around asking the Obama administration to give us the gift of peace, and to use that language in November and December during a time of year when many in this country are sort of thinking along those lines. And one of the points that isn't in there that I really appreciate you reminding us today is that, you know, I think too much of the language in our dialogue is around, you know, the war in Syria and U.S. role in a future war. And I think what really maybe needs to be in this gift of peace is yes, get out of Afghanistan, but this notion of stopping the arming of the resistance, because it is a well-known secret that the United States is sending massive arms, not the kind of heavy artillery that the government enjoins, but we are sending massive arms through Turkey to the resistance groups that are then going into Syria. So we are as much a proxy player in the arming of these groups as Iran, as Saudi Arabia, as everyone else who has a foot on the neck of Syrians. And so so hopefully, if you are on our mailing list, you'll get some sort of announcement about this unity around the gift of peace that the peace groups are talking about this year. And I also just want to thank you all for making time to join us.
I'm not sure. Thank you. Please stand by.